Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's often said there is no such thing as too much money, and that is quite possibly true on a personal level. But in a global economy still trying to work its way out of recession, too much cash can indeed be more curse than blessing. Today on the program, what a bubble looks like as it gets going. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday today, the 20th of November. Glad to have you with us. Think about this for just a second. At one point this morning, the yield on short-term Treasury bills was negative. Buyers were effectively paying the government to hold on to their money. Same thing happened last fall after Lehman Brothers collapsed, when super-safe Treasury bills were about the only thing that anybody trusted. This time, though, the cause seems to be extra money looking for a home. And our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains it is not just happening here, and it is not just the bond market.
Tiny bubble. Some economists are worried the world's central banks have created new asset bubbles by flooding the big financial institutions with cash. They fear the banks are back to their risky gambling habits in pursuit of the most attractive financial returns. Ted Weisberg is a Wall Street broker who heads Seaport Securities. He's crossing his fingers it's not just wishful thinking that's been pumping up stock values.
I don't know if that's fair value or not fair value, because stock markets tend to look forward, not backwards. And hopefully part of this rally that we've seen is the stock market looking forward at an improving economy as we go forward.
The plentiful cash hasn't just been pumping up Wall Street. Bloomberg News reports today several Asian countries are worried international investors might be artificially inflating their currencies. Money manager Axel Merck says those countries need to do more to keep their economies under control. If they don't, recent history could repeat itself.
The risk of a bubble bursting is the same as we had last year. When all asset classes move up in tandem, the risk is that when the bust happens, everything falls down, crashes in tandem, and that means there's no place to hide.
In Shanghai, real estate speculators are still building skyscrapers, even in the face of a 50% vacancy rate. And William Gamble of Emerging Market Strategies says that should worry Americans.
They have a lot of our bonds. I mean, if they start selling massive amounts of treasury to plug holes in their banking system, which they've done in the past, that could create an issue for us, especially now.
Critics say it shows central banks around the world need to start putting the brakes on. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
About those central banks and their role in all this that Bob mentioned, the House Financial Services Committee passed a bill last night that would give Congress more power over the Federal Reserve, including the ability to force Ben Bernanke and the gang down at the Fed to open up their books. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Auditing the Fed would shine a bright light on previously secretive transactions with banks and foreign governments. Auditors could examine the Fed's inner debates on interest rates and find out if the Fed was quietly trying to stop this financial crisis before it got started, or perhaps inadvertently encourage the kinds of risky investments that led to the collapse.
And the audit will tell us a lot about that.
William Greiter is author of Secrets of the Temple. He says a thorough audit is overdue, and he believes it's crazy for Congress to try to reform the financial system until lawmakers fully understand the Fed from the inside.
And out of that, we, the people, will have a completely different understanding of what happened and what the government ought to do to change things.
But Ted Truman is worried. He's a former economist who sat in on Fed open market committee meetings for years. He says sometime soon, the Fed's going to need to raise interest rates.
When they make that decision, there will be people in the market, and certainly politicians, who will say that's a mistake. And they will demand an audit.
Truman fears that if Fed policymakers know an audit is coming, they're likely to be too cautious, delay a rate increase, and
interest rates will be kept too low for too long, and you will actually feed the next asset price bubble.
Truman says feeding a bubble is exactly the same mistake the Fed made just 4 years ago. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Earlier this week, you might remember, a federal panel said most women in their 40s don't need to get mammograms. Today, a physicians group said screenings for cervical cancer can start later and be done less frequently. As the Senate gets set to vote on health care tomorrow night, both of these recommendations seem to be medicine by the numbers, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
For years, our medical system focused on the individual. The thinking was, even if only one life was saved, everyone should get tested. But the new studies show not everyone needs screening. In fact, too much screening can do more harm than good. Dr. Louise Russell studies preventive care at Rutgers University. She says patients have to change their mindsets. Think about the odds of finding lethal cancer.
The evidence we have accumulated through these massive screening programs has shown us that many cancers don't need to be found. We didn't know that before.
Russell says those cancers would never grow big enough to kill. She says patients need to trust the odds and not get screened if they're not at increased risk, if they don't, say, have a family member with cancer. Dr. Otis Brawley is the chief medical officer of the American Cancer Society. He disagrees with the mammogram recommendations. He says even if one life in 1,000 is saved, it's worth it.
If you have evidence that it saves lives, you can't hold back this therapy.
A lot of patients feel the same way. They don't care about the big picture. Dr. Robert Aronowitz teaches the history and sociology of science at the University of Pennsylvania. He says it's hard to change that way of thinking, but people can put themselves in danger. Unnecessary cancer treatment can cause anxiety and even death.
But unless you see the way the whole system works, the larger picture, I think it's hard to evaluate the efficacy of individual things.
Aronowitz says that applies to all kinds of preventive treatment, from screenings to drugs that are supposed to prevent disease. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a whole lot of eh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is going to sound a little off, seeing as how just a couple of minutes ago I was telling you about bubbles, but this was not a stellar week economy-wise. We got state-by-state unemployment figures this morning. Jobless rates increased in 29 of the states in the union. Corporate profits have been kind of a mixed bag, and the housing market, well, as it turns out, that's where we're going to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond with Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, John Carney from ClusterStock.com as well. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Glad to be here.
We are gathered here today, folks, to talk about housing. And the question I'm going to put to you first, Lee Gallagher, is this. How much trouble is housing in this country still in?
Well, it's still in a lot of trouble. And I think we've learned this week that it's in more trouble than everyone, I think, thought. There were some glimmers of hope earlier this year with sales hitting higher levels and demand seemingly coming back. But this week, we really got some bad news. First, new home starts were down 10%, and that's a signal of construction and building. More importantly, we just keep getting more information about the rising number of delinquencies, people that are either in foreclosure now or at risk at coming into foreclosure.
John, let me get your take on that one. What do you think?
I think we've now hit the second leg down in housing, and in part because unemployment is going so high, we're seeing a lot of people who otherwise had perfectly sensible mortgages running into trouble making their mortgage payments. We're no longer in the subprime, crazy mortgages going bad. It's now quite regular mortgages that are also running into trouble.
All right. Well, John, let me ask you this then. Can the economy get better if housing keeps bumping along the muddy bottom?
I think it can get better in the long run if housing stays low, but it's going to slow the economy a lot. We don't need housing to suddenly snap back for the economy to come back, but it's going to be a long time before people can feel like they have a lot of money because their home prices are going up and up.
And more than that, I mean, housing is sort of like it sits right in the middle of the economy. I mean, so many other industries rely on it. When people buy a new home, they rush out and furnish it. And then it just, I mean, the construction industry is an incredible employer and has been in particular with the housing boom. So it's definitely going to hold things back. But I do agree with John. I mean, we can still move forward. It's just going to be a different kind of forward.
All right. Well, I won't hold you to this, but when are we going to move forward?
It's funny. I mean, we are talking to some people who are predicting that housing prices are going to turn around in the third quarter of next year. As to when other things turn around, I think the big question is still unemployment, which just continues to surprise and not in a good way. So I don't think we can truly count on when things are going to turn around.
John, third quarter next year sounds really far away.
It seems very far away. I'm going to be even more negative, but even more precise. June of 2011 is when we will all start to feel like the economy has actually really recovered.
The 14th, 15th, where? Somewhere?
The 13th.
All right. Okay, good. 13th. We'll have you back on that day. Listen, let me change gears here for 1 second. Turn back the clock to last spring. We talked a lot about Timothy Geithner and some of the problems he was having in his public presentation of the administration's plans. There were people calling for his head back then, and now just this week in Congress, there are people calling for the Treasury Secretary to resign. Lee, what do you think?
Many people think that he has really kind of given Wall Street and the financial services firms a good deal on almost every single government plan that has been concocted to get us out of the crisis. And there is some truth to that. But I think what's happening here is that there's just a vast disconnect right now between what's happening on Wall Street and on the ground with unemployment, with people losing jobs. The more that kind of intensifies, people are just going to look for a bad guy, and he is an easy target.
John, Timothy Geithner punching bag or Timothy Geithner man in trouble?
I think Timothy Geithner is being scapegoated by congressmen who voted for the very programs that he carried out. If they really think that something else should have been done about the economy, they should come forward and say that. They're not doing that. Instead, they supported the policies and the president who was pushing for all of the things that have happened that have helped Wall Street recover tremendously. And then they're lashing out at the guy who was deputized to carry that out. It's a joke.
Very quickly, one-word answer, John. You think he's going to resign or not?
No.
Lee?
No.
Lee Gallagher, Fortune Magazine, John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks for having us.
If you know nothing else about the game of soccer, you probably still have heard the name David Beckham. The British player was signed by the Los Angeles Galaxy 3 years ago for a staggering amount of money. Expectations were appropriately high, but Beckham hasn't really done much to meet them. In fact, fans have been downright disappointed. That could change this weekend, though. Beckham and the Galaxy play Salt Lake for the Major League Soccer Championship, and win or lose, Beckham at last seems to be earning his money, as Nancy Fargali reports.
Let's just say the season didn't start so well for David Beckham. Fans booed him at his first game back with the LA Galaxy in July. Tom Payne is the president of the LA Galaxy.
One thing I got from some people around the league was, wow, your fans really got on David. They really do care.
Nice spin from the team's president. But David Carter sees it differently. He's the executive director of USC's Sports Business Institute.
I don't know that the fans have necessarily embraced Beckham in Southern California or around the league as much as they have accepted him. The injuries, the scheduling challenges, and all the rest of it. I think they expected him to show up and, from the very beginning, elevate the franchise.
Here's a newsflash for the fans. Turns out he did. In 2007, the LA Galaxy sold 600,000 jerseys worldwide when Beckham signed. Sports economists say the franchise is now worth $100 million, and the team with Beckham has been invited to play overseas. Galaxy president Tom Payne says those appearances can bring in seven figures.
There's always this debate about, you know, whether bringing David was the right thing or wrong thing. Well, I'm the guy who has to run the business here, and it's absolutely the right thing.
Beckham is making nearly $7 million this year, the highest salary in the league. But Payne says Beckham's made the team a global brand, and from a marketing perspective, that's right on target. In Los Angeles, I'm Nancy Fergali for Marketplace.
Coming up, how the recession reinvented the thrift store.
This isn't sort of cheap and nasty anymore. This does have a certain contemporary, modern feel to it.
But first, let's do the numbers. There were some more signs today that investors might be having some second thoughts about the heights to which they have driven stocks lately. The Dow Industrials trimmed 14 points, a tenth of 1%, finished at 10,318. The NASDAQ carved off another 10 points, half percent, 2146 at the bell. The S&P 500 lost 3 points, which amounts to a third of 1%, wrapped up at 1,091. It was a mixed week for stocks overall. The Dow ended up gaining 0.5% since Monday. The Nasdaq shed 1%. The S&P 500 was off 0.2% for the week. Dell was the biggest drag on the Nasdaq. The computer maker shares fell 10% today, that on the heels of a sharp drop in third quarter profits. We all know home sales have been bad, but D.R. Horton's results were even worse than most analysts expected. The home builder's stock fell more than 15% today on weak profits and a gloomy outlook. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. Marketplace is distributed by American Public Media. For information about underwriting this or other APM programs, such as The Splendid Table, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for the month of October. What do we think about debt as we go into the holiday season? The Consumer Federation of America and the Credit Union National Association talk about consumer spending plans. And the first edition of the magazine Life was published on November 23rd, 1936. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. One of the big things the UN climate change meeting in Copenhagen next month was supposed to help figure out is what the rules are going to be. How does the global economy get from here to there as we try to figure out how to control greenhouse gas emissions? It's no small question, not least because there is all kinds of money to be made in a green economy. But companies need money, fresh new capital, to make money. The International Energy Agency figures it's going to take $45 trillion to transition from oil and gas to low-carbon energy worldwide. Total investment so far? Only about $1 trillion or so, in part because nobody knows what those new rules and regulations are going to be. Kevin Parker is the head of global asset management at Deutsche Bank. Kevin, it's good to have you on the program.
Good to be here.
Why do we need regulation to make this investment more attractive?
We need regulation in order to reduce the risk, the regulatory risk. You know, when investors sit down and they take their fancy spreadsheets out and they start to look at all the risks of their investments, given all the other potential investments all over the world today in all kinds of asset classes and opportunities, if renewable energy has a higher degree of regulatory risk associated with it, all else being equal, investors will choose to put their money somewhere else.
What does that mean, regulatory risk?
You've had a series of regulations that have happened in this country have created a very favorable environment for the development of, say, wind energy. When those tax credits have gone away, because they've been set for 2 years or 3 years, when they've gone away, we've seen a dramatic drop-off in further development. So this stop-start notion of regulations that favor it and then are taken away because of political reasons or other reasons, that really kills equity investment.
So where do you like right now? What is a good country? Give me an example of a place that has good rules and regulations for green investment.
Well, we're Deutsche Bank. Our home country is Germany, and it's not the reason we're saying this, but Germany is the leader today. Germany has created unquestionably the right regulatory framework to foster energy efficiency and renewable energy development. Germany is out in front.
I'm almost afraid to ask this, but what's your take on the United States and the regulatory framework here?
Well, we've bucketed countries around the world into risk categories, risk one, two, and three, and the U.S. is in the middle of the pack.
Well, at least we're not at the end, right? I mean, at least we're not down at the bottom.
We're not down at the bottom. However, if we're the world's biggest polluter, we should really have the best regulatory environment for going after it and the lowest risk environment, and it's not a very good story.
What can the U.S. do then to make itself more attractive and to get a leg up in this race to the green technology?
Well, it falls into two categories. There's a long-term framework, which is what cap and trade is really meaning to get at.
Cap and trade, this device by which you cap the emissions and then you trade the pollution quotas, basically.
Exactly. And the Waxman-Markey bill, the Senate bill, that addresses putting a price on carbon and a cap on carbon long-term. It doesn't address the near-term issues of capital formation and getting after the opportunities in renewable energy and energy efficiency.
What I hear you saying is that in this country, we are largely nibbling around the edges.
The system we have in the U.S. today is a bit of a quagmire, frankly, because the states all sort of go off and do their own thing. We don't have federal legislation, which is difficult. We have 29 states have renewable state-level renewable portfolio standards. It's a myriad of regulations and requirements, and what that does is it prevents the system from really scaling up.
Kevin Parker, he's the head of global asset management at Deutsche Bank. Kevin, thanks a lot.
Great to be here.
The retail industry seems to be a lot like housing the past couple of months. One day you get a report that says it's in the dumps, the next you get some number that doesn't seem so bad. But whatever the statistics do say, the retail mood out there is generally grim for most mainstream stores. But stores that rely on donated goods are doing pretty well. All those commercial real estate vacancies, they're the perfect opportunity for thrift shops to broaden their horizons. Gigi Duban reports now from Birmingham, Alabama.
30-year-old Stacy Peavy had never shopped in a thrift store. But when she walked into one in Gardendale, Alabama, to her surprise, the place smelled great.
It was clean. It was organized. You know, for a thrift store, I thought that was a plus.
Peavy was at the newest location of a chain called America's Thrift Stores. Her shopping cart was loaded with about a half dozen brand-name suits.
It's a $145 suit. Great condition. You see what I'm saying? $988. You believe that?
Peavy needs the suits for her job at the Social Security office, but she doesn't have lots of money to throw around. Her husband recently was laid off from the U.S. Postal Service, and the couple have a teenage daughter. Like so many others, Peavy was thrust into thrift shopping by the recession. Now there's another market thrift store owners are courting, people with a little more spendable income. The strategy? Follow the money.
See, we try to locate our stores in affluent areas.
That's Timothy Alvis, president of America's Thrift Stores. It's a for-profit chain with 14 stores across the Southeast. Most of the store's inventory is donated, and the thrift chain gives half its profit to charity. It's important to note that when Alvis says affluent, he means people with a little extra money to spend. People who spend $3 on a shirt, not because they have no choice, but because it's a bargain. Problem is, real estate agents haven't always welcomed thrift stores into higher income neighborhoods.
You're wanting to grow and you're out there looking and people say, thrift store. You know, go back down to that side of town.
Now, commercial developers are less selective about their tenants.
Right now, of course, there's a lot of retail spaces available. So they're like anybody else. They'd rather have somebody paying rent than nobody.
That's how the company got its foot in the door this summer in Gardendale, a booming suburb of Birmingham, Alabama, where the median household income is about $56,000. It's opening another store in the college town Athens, Georgia. Alvis says it's not that they want to exclude poor customers.
But those people will come to an affluent area and shop in a thrift store, where people in an affluent area will not go down in a poor part of town and shop.
The trick, Alvis says, is getting people in the door.
We've even considered changing our name, taking the thrift store out of it.
Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail, a marketing consulting firm. She says two factors are working in thrift stores' favor, the recession and the green movement.
Real estate developers are, you know, recognizing a desperate need, but also that, again, this isn't sort of cheap and nasty anymore. This does have a certain contemporary, modern feel to it, whether it's, you know, value or it's good for the environment.
The National Association of Resale and Thrift Shops, a trade group that monitors the industry, says new shops are opening throughout the U.S. at a faster rate than pre-recession. And 67% of stores it surveyed said sales today are up a third over last year.
This recession, because it's been so cataclysmic, it's exposed more people to the thrift shop that perhaps hadn't even thought about it before.
What do you like it?
But Liebman offers this bit of advice. Don't get too fancy. She says if thrift stores lose too much of that musty aroma, consumers might just start to think the bargains aren't all that amazing after all. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note before we go, a chance on a Friday afternoon to get a head start on your weekend with the news that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Noonan, and the Marketplace staff.
Tess Bigland, host of Marketplace Money, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
The million-dollar cow.
Explain.
Missy, a Canadian cow, was bought for $1.2 million.
Why so much?
She apparently got a flawless rating under the Bovine Genetic Index.
She is genetically perfect.
She is genetically perfect, although they don't say what makes her so perfect.
Yeah, even a goose that literally lays golden eggs is only going to bring in like $1,100 an ounce.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace. What's your story this week?
An Eggo waffle shortage.
No.
Yes. They had some flooding at their Atlanta facility, and their Tennessee bakery has having some equipment issues, and there's going to be an Eggo waffle shortage through the middle of next year.
There was a flood?
There was a flood.
That's one situation where you do not want to let go your Eggo.
Yes, it's true.
You could drown.
Ben Adair, editorial director, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Marijuana busts.
And what exactly is new about marijuana busts?
In the San Fernando Valley this week, cops busted up a huge warehouse full of pot 25 feet from the station's back door. The cops apparently smelled pot coming from the building, and then a week later they busted them.
They were smelling pot from behind the station, and it took them a week? What, did they have a contact high?
Yeah, you know, launch the investigation and then just chill out, bro.
That is just the barest taste of what Rico and Brendan have to offer. You can hear more on their podcast. It is called The Dinner Party Download. There's a link, of course, on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow lost 14 points, a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ gave back 10 points, a half percent. The S&P 500 slid a bit, 3 points, a third of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, what to do when you hear about any investment that offers returns with no risk.
Put one hand on your wallet and run for your life. You are about to be snookered.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here Monday afternoon. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.